Welcome to this episode of Poking Holes in Blinders. Today, we tackle such topics as educational theory, letter of the law versus the spirit of the law, and the moronity of stop signs. With me, as always, Dr. Brian Height.
The moronity of stop signs. You're just making up your own words right from the beginning. I love it. But I'll tell you what, I love the sentiment because stop signs, they are moronic. They're stupid. And I love talking about them. So this is going to be a fun episode.
I can't wait to get into it. So first off, how you been, man? It's been a little while since the last time we talked.
It has been a little while since we talked. Yeah, I've been great, man. Life's been moving along pretty well. You know, the business is working and the kids are healthy and most of the time happy. And that makes life easy, too. What about you?
Well, I've been doing pretty good. My kids have been back at school for a bit now, and I just love the school that they go to. It's called Manzanita School and Institute, and it's in Topanga Canyon here in California. I'd call it an academic hippie school. They have inside spaces, but their classrooms are actually outside classrooms. They have desks underneath canopies, and I'm sure it can only happen in a place like California when we get 284 days of sun. But I also appreciate that their mentality there is that there's no bad weather. It's just bad clothing. So even when it rains, they're out there in their slickers trying to take notes. It is also accredited by the state. So it's not that we're just like sending them to a school where they just stay outside all day doing nothing. But it's actually pretty impressive. When they had their end of semester presentations last year, I was just blown away by the amount of information that they learned in this non-traditional type of schooling. Totally different from like how you and I learned when we are always in desks inside and bells and clocks. This total outside the box education. I think they're going to be better off in the future than we are.
That sounds great, man. And absolutely the complete opposite of my experience with the school here where I live with my kids. In fact, I just got a message from the teacher last week that she was asking for candy to be brought in by the parents as rewards for the kids' learning, behavior, things that they do. I don't know, just all the wrong stuff that should not be happening in schools in 2022 is still being done regularly in these classrooms. I mean, just put out the message asking for candy with no shame whatsoever. So that's great. And I love that line, too. There is no bad weather. There are only bad clothes.
They're asking for candy, like candy, which has like yellow number 5 and something that's linked to ADHD, like that kind of candy.
Yeah, they are asking for candy that's loaded with sugar in the middle of a childhood epidemic of obesity to manipulate the kids into doing what kids are normally and naturally motivated to do, which is learn.
What are you going to do? Are you going to play along? Or are you going to try to get some, bring in an apple or a banana or something?
No, I am on this occasion beyond what it is that I've already done, which is write on their school survey a little bit about my dissatisfaction and to write to the superintendent of the school system about my dissatisfaction. I'm going to leave it alone at that. And I have fought this battle with teachers in the past, with principals in the past. It is just not a battle that I can win. So they are going to continue to resort to rewards to try to get kids to do what they want them to do instead of just creating an environment that fosters creativity and growth and just natural curiosity. That's what kids need, but that is not what they're getting. So that's great that your kids are. That sounds like a wonderful school.
Thanks, man. It is amazing that in that environment, they are excited about learning. It's a special environment, and I don't know how you'd be able to recreate that across the whole nation, but there is actually a push of different education institutes and facilities that are going for this non-traditional method of teaching, and it's popping up all over the state. So it's actually exciting for future kids and future generations to get more of a whole body experience as opposed to getting a hubba bubba for doing 2 + 2. You know what I mean?
Yeah, or a marshmallow. And that's a true story. My daughter received marshmallows for getting a correct answer. That's something that actually happened. Yeah, there's plenty of research out there in the education world that shows that creating a motivation and an environment that fosters motivation through rewards is not the right way to go. That creating an environment that allows kids to be curious and to connect their learning to actual, real, no kidding things that they care about. That's motivating. That's what gets kids to lean in and not only acquire the information, but remember the information later on. What it is that's happening at that school that you're talking about, that's been in line with at least a decade or more of research. What's happening at the school where I'm talking about, that is antiquated, hard-headed stubbornness. That is.
Yeah. So. I would say that last year, I had reservations about going into a school like this because of the unknown. Like, I know how I learned, and I know that I turned out fairly okay. Just because we did it in the past doesn't mean that that's the way we should do it in the future. But obviously we were open to trying this new method of school. And one of their main missions is to foster a connection with the planet. So they have Earth stewardships on Fridays where they go cross grades. Like, they get a group of students from different grades and they go out onto the land and they have responsibilities to working together and get that connection with the land. What that facilitates, like you were saying, is a curiosity for the things around them. And since they are always outside, even when they do their academics, they're still outside. They actually call them hawk days and owl days. The owl days, they sit at their desks and they go through the academics. As I said, it's still accredited by the state. They still have milestones in academics that they have to show that their students are accomplishing. And their hawk days are like they're out on the land. It's a fully immersive learning environment when they're talking and walking and learning about what the plants are there. And I also think the teachers do a job about bringing the academics into it when they're out there. The one thing that really turned for me on accepting how great this school is my daughter and I, we had a daughter dad day. We had this day planned and we went to the American Girl, this whole big two-story building. I had no idea the whole company was really about trying to push equality for women and girls. But I started talking about Katherine Johnson, one of the NASA mathematicians that did calculations that got us to the moon, who I found out about in the movie Hidden Figures. And then my daughter stood there for 3 minutes and gave me all of this information and facts about Katherine Johnson that she learned in school. And I was just blown away. And at that moment, I'm like, yeah, I'm 100% in on this school. This is truly an amazing way of teaching kids. And fortunately, we are in an environment that they can facilitate this academics and this care of the planet and how they coincide together.
Yeah, a couple times you mentioned a few things that I think are really important. One is that you called it non-traditional, and you said that you didn't really know whether deviating from the way that you and I learned was a good thing to do or not. And that brings to mind what seems to be the motto of this school that my kid goes to. And that is, we do it that way because that's how we've always done it. And to me, those words are like nails on a chalkboard. I can't stand it. That's not a good enough reason to do anything, because that's the way we've always done it is a perfect reason to start looking for a different way to do it. So it's a big difference in philosophy between the school and me. And it's what we have at the moment. She'll be there for the rest of this year, and then she moves to a different school where I don't know that the philosophy is going to be any different, but we'll see. The thing that my daughter is most excited about at school actually happens outside of school hours. She is part of what's called Book Squad, and I take her to school early on a couple days a week, and she goes to the library, and she just helps. She helps the librarian. She reshelves books. She checks out people who are checking out books. She goes into classrooms sometimes and reads to or helps younger kids read. And this is all in, you know, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes or so before school actually starts. That's her favorite thing. But that's the thing that she's able to actually use some of the learning. She's learning through this process of engagement with an activity that she loves, reading. To me, if more of school was that, in other words, you get the information and then you figure out how to integrate the information in life, that's the gold standard, in my opinion. Sounds like that your school's got that And I hope more schools do start moving that direction. I don't know what the trend is in public education. I know that what I'm saying is not news to anybody. I know it's not brand new. It shouldn't be earth-shattering information to anybody in the education world that, number one, kids are naturally, intrinsically motivated to learn. They're naturally curious. And when information is presented in an environment that's interesting to the kids, then they're more likely to learn that information and retain that information. That is absolutely not novel at all. Why it's not incorporated more regularly into public schools, that's a question I don't know. Now, I'm not a public educator. I don't spend every day in a classroom with 20 kids with the various restrictions and requirements that various school boards put on these teachers and in these institutions. And I get that there's a whole nother world behind the curtain that I'm not aware of. But I also think that the teachers do have, and even the principals within the schools have unique opportunities to create environments that make it so that kids think learning is fun, that they enjoy learning. I don't know. That's something that I think is really important.
I would agree too. Before we found this school, Dax went to a public school. And in kindergarten, the teacher was awesome. It is amazing how the kids' experience in class is so tied to their experience with their teacher. So in kindergarten, that teacher was amazing. She did such an amazing job about engaging the kids and giving them opportunities to be curious and to get excited about learning, excited about going to school. And then when he moved into first grade, it was a combination class between first and second grade. The teacher was fine, but I also think she was just overwhelmed. The way you're talking about the education is about this is the way we've always done it. My son was given assignments, and his assignments just ended up being just busy work. And he gets so frustrated. He's like, I already know this. I'm just doing busy work, trying to get through the assignment just because that's the assignment and it's just busy work. And he was telling me that in class, there would be some problems between kids, and he pretended to be asleep so that he wasn't involved in whatever was going on. And the teacher was just trying to do her best, but she was definitely overwhelmed. There was a situation that happened on a field trip. They were headed to the Getty, and there was a tram that goes up the hill to the museum. And some of the kids were misbehaving, as they do. And the teacher yelled at them and said, sit down, I'm not going to lose my job over you. That was her mentality. How can you effectively teach with that kind of mentality? And like you were saying about what happens behind the curtain, but what is the overall theory about education in public systems for children? And how do you teach a mass of children while trying to facilitate their individualness? How do you facilitate that curiosity for education for kids? Like you said, they want to learn.
Yeah, I think two things come to mind when you're talking about that. One is, it's the definition of success. What is success? And in public education, success are test scores. Like, that's how success is defined. And that's important because it's tied to money. Now, here's some backward rationale for you that still exists. Schools that do badly get less money. The schools are incentivized to have high grades. That's what they're incentivized to do. If they get, you know, a certain rating based on their test scores and their overall improvement and all of these things, then they get more funding. If the grades are lower, then they don't get the funding. But what that also incentivizes is schools cheating. And by cheating, I mean just simply passing students. For example, the schools here where I live, it's just wrong. What they do is, in the high school, they let the kids make up like late assignments, not a big deal. They can make them up whenever, as long as it's before the end of a quarter. If they do badly on a test, they can retake the test. I think they can retake it as many times as they want until they finally get whatever score it is that they want. I think there may be a limit on, if you make above this score, then you can't retake it. But if you make below this, then you can retake it. They bend over backwards in every way possible to set conditions so that no child fails. I mean, it is damn near impossible to fail at that school. And I think that that's wrong. I think it does a disservice to the kids. I think that, particularly at the high school level, it sets them up for failure. out in life. Life doesn't bend over backwards to make sure that you get multiple opportunities to turn in things by a certain due date. The level of responsibility that could be communicated to kids isn't. So one is what success looks like. If success looked different from test scores, I think that things would be better. So for example, if success was within student improvement, so if the student started out with a baseline score on some sort of test of 83 and improved to an 87, then that improvement over the, you know, same thing, if a student started out with a 65 and improved to 69, that's still improvement, and that should count rather than just the 69 counting as the end score. Now, granted, a 69 is still bad. You know, I mean, a student who only understands 69% of what he or she is supposed to understand, that's not a good situation, but at least there has been improvement. And I think that that improvement should get factored in along with the test score, as opposed to the test score being the be all end all in terms of defining success. So I think that changing the definition of success, maybe even measuring some psychological measures. So what type of motivation exists? What type of climate? Like, how do the kids perceive their environment? How do they perceive their teachers? What is their confidence level? What's their engagement level? Because all of those, like, you know, intrinsic autonomous motivation, high levels of confidence, high levels of engagement, student engagement, those things are predictors of performance. So rather than focusing on the end state, the outcome, the test score, I think schools should pay a lot more deliberate attention to those factors that contribute to that end state, those test scores. So again, creating that environment that really focuses on and fosters confidence, that creates an environment that where they really focus on and try to enhance that intrinsic, autonomous, internal motivation, that motivation that comes from within, where they offer kids opportunities to choose assignments and help kids make the connection between the information and the real world, things that they actually care about, things that matter to the kids themselves, where they see the relevance of what it is that they're doing. So that to me is one of the biggest issues, is just redefining what success looks like. And the other is allowing principals and teachers the freedom to create, to be creative with how information comes out. So trusting is really what it comes down to, is trust. So again, we're defining success in terms of test scores. What I'm saying is that if we focus on these other issues, if we raise kids' confidence, kids' motivation, kids' engagement levels, then we will get the outcomes, but we have to trust that. And I don't think that trust is there. We're taking practice tests for other tests that are practicing for the real test that's going to go to the state, and all, it's this big thing. And the kids feel the pressure. The teachers feel the pressure. The teachers communicate that to the kids. All of these things are turned into such a big deal. These tests, so huge within the schools. Rather than just trusting, look, if we create this environment that lets kids lean in and really enjoy learning, we're going to get the outcome that we want. We just have to sit back and trust that. That trust is not happening. And I don't think that the principals and teachers are often allowed as much freedom as they probably should be to create those conditions that I'm talking about. I still think that there are ways, even within the system, to do much better than handing out candy to try to get kids to do well on a thing. But I think that the teachers could be offered more freedom to really design environments that create that opportunity for kids to lean in and just be curious and interested and grow and learn in a way that is just naturally there for them.
Well, that sounds like a lot of work.
I'm sure it is a lot of work, and it's much easier to just look at, oh, what's the end test score? Oh, you got an average of 94? Got it. Okay, well, you guys get money. You got an average of 72? Well, you don't get any money. Because in Tennessee, they have what are called outcome incentives for high reading scores, college career readiness. You get extra money if these scores are high. But if those scores are low, you don't get any money. And to me, that's just backwards, number one, because it does create incentives for schools to fudge the numbers a little bit, to change their policies the way that I was talking about, where it just makes it almost impossible for kids to get low scores, to for anybody to fail. It's just a backwards system that makes no logical sense whatsoever. What we need to be doing is incentivizing schools to create these environments. And we can certainly measure success. I think test scores are a fine way to measure success. I think that standards are better than the straight up traditional old way of doing things. In other words, there's a standard. There's a standard that we expect kids to meet. And when they meet this standard, that's what we're going for. And the standard is connected to and logically flows from and toward all the other information that the student is going to be presented with throughout the education process. So standards-based education is where a lot of places are going. And I think that makes a lot of sense. But you have to connect it to some kind of score. And I don't know, man, I like numbers and I understand the importance of numbers. I understand the importance of test scores. And I think that they can communicate useful information. But I also think that when they are the be-all, end-all, and when the focus is on the outcome rather than the process required to achieve that outcome, which is what I think probably the biggest problem is that we're fixated on the test scores. We're giving all these practice tests, thinking if we just have the kids take enough tests, they'll get good at taking tests, and then they'll get the scores that we need, rather than focusing on the process necessary for the kids to learn and retain the information that the test is asking.
Yeah, you're right, man. That's just a shitty way of doing it. There's got to be a better way. When your school does poorly, you need more resources to be able to do better. And it's the schools that are affluent do better, but then you don't need to give them full funding. It should go to the ones that are the poorer schools because they need more resources to be able to help try to bring better education to their students.
I certainly think that money does play a role, but there is some research out there that shows that. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, and I certainly don't have them memorized. This is not my area of expertise at all.
I'm a little disappointed that you don't have them memorized, just a little bit, just so you know. Did I derail you there?
Oh, my God. Are you going to keep talking?
Probably.
You got me all discombobulated. Go ahead. Say some stuff. I don't know what I'm even saying right now.
What you were saying about maybe educators being handcuffed in a certain way of facilitating education for their students. One of the things you and I were talking about before this was the letter of the law as opposed to the spirit of the law and how those things are opposed to each other at times. One of the things that you brought up were stop signs and yield signs. What was your example of coming to a stop sign?
Yeah, well, I can tell you about stop sign situation is right down the street from my house and I experience it all the time. It's a T intersection, which if you go to the Department of Transportation site, it'll tell you don't put a stop sign at the T intersection of the crossroad, like the top part of the T, the road that goes through. Now, the one that meets that road, there should be a stop sign there for those people to turn left or right. But the one that goes through the T, you don't put a stop sign there. But the people in my little town, they wanted to put a stop sign. Why? Because they wanted to control the speed of the people. They thought people were going too fast through there. Well, if you look at the Department of Transportation website, it'll tell you, don't put a stop sign up in order to control speed. So the whole point of the stop sign is supposed to be to ensure that the intersection is safe, that people aren't smashing into each other in the middle of the intersection. So as we approach this intersection, there are rules. And the rule is that you come to a stop and whoever stops first is the one that gets to go. And if two people come to a stop at the same time, the one to the right is the one that gets to go first. So there are rules, and that's good because we can predict what people are going to do and we can limit the number of wrecks that happen in this intersection. However, when we come to an intersection that has these stop signs and it is abundantly clear that there are no other cars, we are the only vehicle that's there, then the purpose of the law, which is to create a safe environment for the intersection, is no longer valid. It's moot. It doesn't matter because there aren't any other cars to crash into. So the whole purpose of the stop sign goes out the window. You don't need to stop in order to create a safe environment when there is no other car that you could possibly run into. So you mentioned the stop signs, yield signs. My campaign, if I was ever in charge of the world, would be to change all stop signs to yield signs because a yield sign makes sense to me. A yield sign is when you come to this intersection, or this, you know, merging of roads or whatever it is, you take a look. And if it makes sense for you to stop, then you should stop. And if it doesn't make sense for you to stop, then don't stop. Keep going. That's what a yield sign is for. And I think that should be everywhere. There are so many different intersections where we can absolutely see to the left, right, all around us. We know that there are no other vehicles. There's no point in stopping whatsoever. And yet I am continually baffled by how many times I am coming up behind somebody at this intersection. They come to a stop for, I don't know, get out of the car, walk around 360, check the whole thing out, get back in the car, and then go through the intersection. It is absurd, Colin. And it doesn't need to happen that way. So yes, all stop signs should be yield signs. But to get to the point that you're talking about of letter of the law versus spirit of the law, these people believe that the letter of the law is the more important. That the letter of the law, what the law says, that when there's a stop sign, then you come to a complete stop. So I'm coming to a stop sign, therefore I'm going to come to a complete stop. That's all the information I need, is that there's a stop sign and the law says that I stop there. They don't take into account the purpose or the intent of the law. That's irrelevant to them. And to me, that's the whole point. Like, that is the purpose of laws. We live in a supposedly free society, as free as it can be, where our freedom is only curtailed by laws to the extent that to just prevent us from harming other people, to keep our behavior from messing with others' well-being. And in this case, the stop sign does that. If other people are coming to the intersection, then my behavior needs to be constrained such that I don't crash into somebody else. However, when nobody else is around and my behavior now can affect nobody but me, I don't need to follow that law. That law becomes irrelevant.
Have you got a stop sign ticket there at that T intersection? Is that where all this animosities come from about that stop sign at the T?
Yes, but no. Yes, I have gotten a ticket. No, this is not where the animosity is coming from, because it's not just this intersection. Have you ever been sitting at a stoplight and you're sitting there and you look to the left and right and you know, like, nobody is going through the intersection? You're the only person sitting there, but the light's red. And so you're sitting there. Nobody's coming. You can see both directions. You know that there are no vehicles. You could progress through this intersection completely safely, but you don't, because the light's red. Light's red, that means you stop. It means you stay there. That's the law.
Oh, so you actually did that. You looked around, you went through a red light, and then there was a cop there that gave you a ticket. Is that what happened?
No.
You know what I also love? You're like so upset about these stop signs that you went on the Department of Transportation website to find what the intent of stop signs are. That is pretty nerdy research right there, but it's pretty awesome. I appreciate your attention to detail with that.
Well, I'll tell you, man, all it takes is once approaching that intersection from that road where the stop sign was placed. Yes, I went on that site because it makes no sense. It made no sense to me. And you know what? I was happy to know that it made no sense to the experts of transportation who took the time to put on their website when and how a stop sign should and shouldn't be used.
Oh, that's awesome. So getting beyond stop signs and education with the spirit of the law or the letter of the law, have you ever seen Mutiny on the Bounty?
No.
There's been a couple movies made about it, but it's about the real life mutiny that occurred on the Royal Navy sailing ship, the Bounty. Basically, the captain, Captain Bligh, was just a tyrannical dictator, asshole captain. And he treated his crew so poorly that some of the crew members, including the first officer, Fletcher Christian, captured the ship and sent Captain Bligh and a couple other loyalists in an open boat and just sent them out at sea. Fletcher Christian took the Bounty back to Tahiti along with the mutineers, and there were some other officers that remained loyal to Captain Bligh. Somehow Captain Bligh made it back to England, and the Royal Navy sent out another ship to track down the mutineers to bring them back for trial. They found some of them, including one of the officers, Roger Byam, who remained loyal to Captain Bligh. Fletcher Christian was never captured. Back in England, there was a trial for all captured crew members. And even though Roger Byam was held on the Bounty against his will, he still found himself on trial for his life. And in the 1935 film, he gave a speech condemning the actions of Captain Bligh. Now, I'm picking and choosing a couple quotes from that speech, but he said, "There's another story here, Captain Bligh. A story of a man who robbed his seamen, cursed them, flogged them, not to punish, but to break their spirit. A story of greed and tyranny and anger against it and what it cost. One man, my lord, would not endure such tyranny. Fletcher Christian is still free. I do not justify his crime, mutiny, but I condemn the tyranny that drove him to it. He was saying, yes, some of the crew did mutiny, but only because the actions of their captain drove them to it. The letter of the law makes mutiny illegal, but the spirit of the law is to keep order on the ship. And the captain broke that spirit by being an unreasonable tyrant. The captain is to blame for the mutiny, and the mutineers should be pardoned. That's what he was saying. I have a question for you. What are some other big issues that are in our society that has to do with the letter of the law, the spirit of the law? Like, how can a police officer get defunded but still expect to do his job to help serve society?
Well, I think that the police, that's a great place to start, because I mentioned trust with the education system, that we needed to trust principals, to trust teachers, and to trust the fact that if we focus on the little things, the process, those things that when present contribute to performance, that we'll see the outcomes that we want. And I think that trust needs to happen with police as well. And what I mean by that is that police officers should be trusted to make decisions in the field on their own, rather than being handcuffed, so to speak, to the laws that they're to enforce. That what should become more important is the intent of the laws that they enforce. So, for example, the traffic thing is just the easiest one. If I'm coming to a stop sign and a police officer sees me run that stop sign when there are two other cars approaching the same intersection, and he pulls me over and gives me a ticket, that's probably the right thing to do. Because in that situation, my behavior is putting others at risk, and that breaks the intent of this law. However, if the same police officer sees me run this stop sign and there are clearly no cars around, then he or she should not write that ticket, in my opinion, because the intent of the law hasn't been broken in that situation. So I think that if police officers are trained more in terms of evaluating the volatile, uncertain environments in which they navigate regularly, to evaluate what people's behavior is like as it relates to the intent of the various laws, I think that we will be much better off as a society. So that's one place where I really see it, is just not only giving them the freedom to, but expecting them to see each situation differently and treat it as its own unique situation, in which the benefits and drawbacks and nuances of people's behavior is taken into account, rather than did this behavior break this one law the way that the letter of the law states. And that's a really hard thing for people to do. And I think that that's one of the reasons why some people gravitate toward and really latch onto that letter of the law, is that it's very simple. It's very straightforward. There is no ambiguity. You either did or you didn't. When they're written well, which honestly some aren't, when you look at the Constitution, it's very vague, which is why we have all the arguments we do about different things. But when the law is written well, it's straightforward. And you either broke it or you didn't. You either followed it or you didn't. And some people are way more comfortable. I would say most of us are more comfortable in situations that don't have that ambiguity, that don't require us to interpret anything. It's just black or white. It's just that's how it is. But you and I have talked about this before. The world is not black and white, and we as human beings are complex, and we have to start becoming more comfortable dealing with that complexity. And part of that is understanding that every situation is different. Every person is different. Every interaction is different. And we need to embrace that difference and that complexity and evaluate things based on the current circumstances, not in a dogmatic, rule-focused, letter of the law way.
It's interesting because as you're saying it, it comes down to trust. But that's a lot of trust to be comfortable with. I think there's so much uncertainty out there that we try to legalize morality. And having the laws helps us have a through line to hold on to. That situation's an easy situation with a stop sign. If you went through the stop sign, you either caused an unsafe situation or you didn't. I think we have the potential to judge each situation on its own merit. And it would be nice to take a step into that direction to trust people to make the right decisions.
What I think that you were talking about is what I think is most important. And that is, I think that the law itself sometimes becomes more important than, and sometimes stands in the way of, the value and the intent that the law was even created for in the first place. So, for example, a value in my house might be respect, and I might have a rule where people don't interrupt other people.
Is that why you get bothered? You get mad at me because I keep interrupting you? I saw. You're right. You're right. I shouldn't interrupt you.
So I might have that rule in my house that people don't interrupt other people, and I expect my kids to abide by that rule. But there are times when something important is happening and they need my attention. They're kids and they need my attention right then for whatever reason. And so them interrupting is necessary. But the letter of the law, if I was to get mad at my child for interrupting when they fell down and now they're bleeding, but they're interrupting a conversation to tell me that. I mean, think about the alternative. If that kid has internalized the rule, I never interrupt my dad when he's in the middle of a conversation, but my child is sitting there literally bleeding. This happened last night. I was on a Zoom call with a client and my kid just wrecked hard upstairs. I don't know, she was running and just wrecked, hit the ground. And I heard it and I went upstairs, but I had to go to her. She wasn't going to come down to me because she knew that I was in the Zoom call. And that's just one of the things that she knows, if I'm in a Zoom call with a client, that she's not supposed to interrupt me. But I had to teach her. I was like, look, there are times when it's okay to come talk to dad. It's not about the letter of the law. I don't want her to only operate within this one strict interpretation of what's right and wrong. I want you to evaluate the situation. I want you to understand the circumstances and then make the decision that's the best one for you and for those around you in that moment. And in this case, yes, normally respect for privacy and professionalism and everything else might be don't interrupt dad when he's in the middle of a Zoom call. But this time it would have been okay. And so it's just a process of teaching. And that's what I try to teach her. I try to teach her values and big picture areas. These are the things that we should care about. We should care about honesty. We should care about respect. We should care about responsibility and follow through. These are the big picture values. Now, what that looks like is different from situation to situation and from person to person. There's no hard, fast rule that I can give her that's going to apply to all circumstances. I need her to be okay with learning and understanding the nuance and difference within all of the situations so that she can start making the best decisions that she can.
This will tie in, trust me, but have you watched Star Trek Discovery?
No.
I'm a huge Star Trek fan and I love Discovery, also Picard and Strange New World. But in the last season of Discovery, one of the main characters was choosing a path that was against what the Federation was doing. He's a good guy, but he's choosing another path because of his personal connection with it. I'm not going to get into the details because I'll just confuse everyone, including myself. But basically, he broke the law. The Federation made a determination on a course of action, and he went against that determination. And in the end of the season, everything all worked out, just so you know. But in the end of the season, he had to go on trial for breaking the law. And there was some recourse for what he did. But the Federation, their perception on that is like his reasons for going this course of action matter. And the severity of his punishment is going to hinge on why he chose that course of action. So it really delved into his personal experience, his mindset, the reason he was doing it. And I love that sentiment. That's what we're talking about. It's like the reasons for things are so important and reasons do matter. So the punishment, even though it's mandated for whatever crime is mandated by law a certain way, but if we could have trust in society, in judges, and to be able to trust that they can make those determinations because of the spirit of the law as opposed to the letter of the law. That would be awesome. That's one of the reasons I love Star Trek, is because just the way their human interactions are, they really are trying to be the best of what humans can be. And it doesn't mean that there isn't conflict or there aren't issues or it's the same stuff that we all go through today. But the way they try to deal with their conflicts is such a uplifting way. And I would hope that we as humans would be able to aspire to that vision of humanity, of how we deal with conflicts.
Well, it's interesting because I think that this idea of letter of the law versus spirit of the law gets into what we've talked about before as well, which is certainty. Because when we operate with the letter of the law, if there's a law present, if there's a rule that exists and we know what it is, then the right thing to do is to follow the rule and the wrong thing to do is to not follow the rule. And we know that. And with that kind of black and white attitude, I can be very certain about what's right and wrong. I can be very certain about what I should do or shouldn't do in any given situation. I should follow the law. I should not break the law. And in our last episode, we talked about some of the challenges associated with that dogmatic, legalistic certainty. That certainty, yes, I know exactly what's right, because it closes our mind. It limits our perspectives. It puts blinders on us. And in that situation, we miss a lot of the interesting color, so to speak, that exists between that black and white. You know, a lot of the nuance, a lot of the difference, a lot of the things that really make life interesting, because that certainty with that closed mind, we're only seeing things from one perspective. And it's one that we're not willing to deviate from because we know it's right. We are certain that it's correct. I think laws and rules are good things. I think that they provide some structure. I think they should operate more like cartilage, though, than like bone. If you want to use like a physical example, I think that they should be sturdy like cartilage, but also flexible like cartilage. They should provide support for society as a whole, but not rigidly so. So that's what I think about that.
That's a great analogy, like cartilage as opposed to bone. I never even thought about it like that. That's one of the reasons I appreciate talking with you, man. You always throw out some sort of thing that I'm like, wow, that's a great perspective. One of the things that I want to discuss, I got some comments back on the first podcast about what are we trying to do? Are we talking about pure individualism to move us forward into the future? Or do we need to be concerned with the societal systems as being in the forefront? I don't want to put all humans into a mixing bowl and we just kind of get this even consistency in color. Like, that's not the purpose of what we're trying to do. I think we are individuals and we do have society. So those things are facts. And when you put them together, say the analogy for me is a salad bowl, where each individual ingredient gets to keep its own virtue, but the salad itself is more delicious than each individual ingredient. So that's what my vision of what we're talking about is. It's like, I don't want to just blend up everything so that there's an even consistent nature to society to be just flat and colorless. It should have colors and keep the colors. And I think we can celebrate that. You know what? It's back to a Star Trek quote. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one. Sometimes, I think sometimes that's important, that the good of the many should outweigh the needs of the one. However, sometimes the needs of the one needs to shine through.
First of all, the salad analogy, I think, is great. And that absolutely stew is another analogy that kind of works the same way, where you have all these different ingredients. Stew wouldn't be stew without all the ingredients, but each ingredient stays the same and it becomes its own thing and adds its own unique flavor. Same thing with the salad. I think that that's a great way of thinking about the relationship between individuals and society.
I also don't like fruit salad, by the way. I'm talking about like normal salad. Fruit salad, when you put all those fruit together, they all just start tasting like each other and it's just nasty. So I'm talking real salad, lettuce, tomato, onion, croutons, chicken. That's the kind of salad I'm talking about, not fruit salad. I just want to be clear.
Okay. Well, we'll have to disagree on that. We can debate that another time. But my point is that, yes, that's a great analogy with the salad, bringing in these different things and the relationship of the individual to the whole. The Star Trek quote, yes, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one. That's what Spock said. However, the whole story revolves around the fact that Kirk is like, no, man, you're wrong. And he puts Spock's needs above everybody else's, like the need of the one. outweigh the need of the many. So yes, there are some times when we need to just understand. This is where wisdom comes in. There's a difference between knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge, information that we know, wisdom, how we use that knowledge. And yes, there are some times when we probably should, in order to act morally and ethically, put more focus on an individual than society as a whole. That's arguable. I'm sure some people would disagree with that. I could see how that could happen. But I don't think that it's an either or with individual and society, because like you said, with this salad analogy, they're both important. We as individuals bring our own unique skills, attitudes, behaviors, just everything that we bring to the table is us. And that's important. Because without that unique contribution, society wouldn't be what it is. Society, remember, is just a group of people. It's just a group of people. That's all it is. And it wouldn't be the same group of people if any of those people left. It would be a different group of people. So I'm not sure exactly what comments you got that led to, are we talking about the individual? Are we talking about society? Because I'm talking about both. I think that we need to set conditions for well-being of each individual that there is. And I think that can happen at a societal level. Is every individual unique and operating in a unique environment? Sure, that is happening. And so individual interventions and different discussions, techniques, I don't know, different things can be used to influence individuals on an individual basis. But I also think that systems can be in place within societies that can benefit the individuals within that society. So I don't know. I don't see a difference between the two. Can you be more specific about what the comments were?
I think it was just asking for clarification. And so the clarification for me is like, we're saying both. I feel like we're saying both. And we're trying to acknowledge the importance of both. And with that awareness of both, that we can actually progress into a better state for the human experience.
The thing that comes to mind, if we just take society out and replace that word with family, it's the same kind of thing. You know, sometimes we act in a way that we do, not because it's really what we want in that moment from a hedonistic standpoint. It's not what we really want to do, but it's what we know is best for the family as a whole. Well, that's the same thing. You just take it and extrapolate it to the larger system. So society has values that exist. We have a culture. There are norms. There are, I don't know, just different things that society cares about. And so sometimes our behavior needs to be such that we think beyond just ourselves, that we think about other people. That's really what it comes down to. And as far as society, laws and culture should be created with those larger values in mind. This is what I'm saying. And it gets back to the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law. I don't think that society should create laws and try to define people's behaviors with law. Society should identify and value certain things and then incentivize those things happening. So again, going back to respect, we don't necessarily need to create a law or a rule that demands respect, but that is something that as a culture, when we're interacting with other people, that we all should just expect from each other. We just have to have the same definition. That's where the problem comes in sometimes. I don't know how many people would disagree with the fact that respect is important. I think that many people would disagree about what respect actually looks like out in the real world, which is also interesting. But it gets down to the education thing too. So we're trying to educate, we want to say societies, the society of kids. We're trying to educate these kids. It's not about creating the rule. These kids must pass this test, this test, this test. We want them to learn. We want them to learn how to think. We want them to learn how to apply knowledge. We want them to embrace curiosity and just be interested in the world, engage in life around them in wise ways. And I think that the education system can create environments. I know that it can. I've read the literature. I know that environments can be created that help foster that interest, that curiosity, that still apply guidance in a way that keeps anarchy from happening. But kids are having fun, they're engaged, and they're learning what they need to learn from a larger standard-based system. I don't see the difference between society and individuals. Society is made up of individuals. And I think that every time we create a cultural moray or any kind of explicit law, even for that matter, it should be for the benefit of the individual, because that's all society is. It's just a collection of people. and we want to set the conditions for all people to thrive. So we have to think bigger. We have to think broader. And that's where the laws, I think, can be counterproductive, because if we do try to legalize every little piece of behavior, we're not going to be able to achieve that broader connection that we can all wrap our heads around. Again, the last time we talked on this podcast, I was saying, I think what would be great for society, what would be great for not just this country, but the world in general, is to identify and agree upon values that matter. And then start talking about what those values look like. What are the behaviors that actually show that we are living out these values? Man, if we could agree on that, that would be huge. And the behaviors don't need to be legalized. It's just, these are the values. These are the things that we care about. Operate within the parameters that demonstrate respect for and care for these values, and everybody's going to be good. And it's not going to look the same every single day for every single person. This is that uncertainty that we have to start becoming more comfortable with. This is that complexity that we need to start getting better at navigating. This idea that the world is not the same yesterday, and it's not going to be the same tomorrow as it was today. We have to be okay with that and really think about things and consider things within that uncertainty and just be okay. Just be okay with uncertainty. That's what we have to do.
We talked about it before about commonalities between cultures. It would be awesome to be able to identify values that we as a civilization can get on board. So I'd like to ask you a personal question. What are the values that are most important to you in your life? You can ask me that question too. And I can even start by telling you what values are the most important in my life.
All right. Well, what do you got?
Well, for me, I really appreciate kindness. I think that is my number one value. I think it's important to treat people with kindness in all situations. I also like fairness, like when people are treated fairly. So kindness and fairness. You had mentioned about respect. It's interesting about respect. I'm just generalizing, but when people talk about being disrespected, like, are you disrespecting me? You disrespected me. Like, it's almost like they're looking for being disrespected. Do you think that their first approach to people is to treat other people with respect? I would say probably not as much. If you demand not being disrespected, then you should treat people with that air of respect that you are hoping to get. Respect for me is important, clearly. However, with kindness and fairness, respect is kind of already in there. So I don't think it needs to be a separate thing. I also think it's important to try to set people up for success. Being a stunt coordinator, I get to hire some people from time to time. And I have high expectations of the people that you hire, which you should, because that's why you're hiring them. However, you also want to put people in a situation where they have a chance of success, as opposed to on the edge of failure. Yeah, it's going to happen. But when you set people up in a positive way so that they can rise to the challenge, I also love giving out information so that people have the most information so that they can make better decisions. I know I'm talking around a little bit. That's just how I do things. That's how my mind works. But I would say fairness, kindness, and in a work situation, setting people up for success.
Well, I'll start with the last one, because I think that beyond a work situation, one of the things that I think is really important is for people to do their best to leave the world better than they found it. And I think that that involves interactions with others. It's one of the reasons why I've always enjoyed working with kids. I see an opportunity to contribute in a way that might help that child's life be better, particularly kids that are in challenging situations. I'm a foster parent, and I've had many kids come into my house. And that's one of the reasons that I do that. I really think it's important to help set others up for success, again, not just in a work environment, but for life. I also value the pursuit of knowledge. I think that everybody should continue to learn, that we should all continue to pursue information, get more knowledge, but not just for knowledge's sake, not just so we can win Jeopardy.
Although that'd be cool too. I'd love to win Jeopardy.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it would be a bad thing. to win Jeopardy, that is. But I do think that the collection of knowledge, just for the sake of knowledge, would be a bad thing. I think that the collection of knowledge should be so that we can operate better in the world. So we develop wisdom. We understand how to apply that knowledge. More knowledge we have, the better able we will be to deal with the circumstances around us in a wise way. I also value perseverance. I think that people should not give up when things are hard. When things are hard, you figure out something else to do and you keep going, you keep pushing. And that kind of leads me into another value that I have is creativity. I think that people should do their best to develop the ability to think outside the box, to consider things from multiple angles. And especially when we experience challenges, that's something that can become extremely helpful, is just getting used to thinking creatively. All right, well, this way isn't working. Well, what could? What are some possibilities? What are some options? So for me, yeah, setting others up for success, the pursuit of knowledge, perseverance, and along with all of those really is creativity. Let's think outside the box and come up with some new ways of doing stuff, of setting people up for success, of gaining knowledge and applying that knowledge, of persevering through the challenges that we experience. Let's figure out some creative new ways of doing that. I think that those are some of the values that I really care about.
Listening to your values, I value those things too. Getting back to perseverance and how important it is, has been in my life, to keep progressing. Being a stuntman, most of the time, yeah, I'd say most of the time, when I see the things that I've done that made it to film, I'm usually disappointed with it. Just mildly, I'm mildly disappointed. I was thinking at the time, like, yeah, this is right. This is going to be awesome. And then I see it and I'm like, I chose to do it that way. And I think there's a benefit in being mildly disappointed, because then it forces me to continue to grow, to have more perseverance, to try to keep getting better and better. Because if I was 100% satisfied with it, then I wouldn't need to keep growing. I'm like, yeah, that's awesome. That's as good as it could ever be. But I think there's a benefit of recognizing that it's okay to be a little disappointed, because then it helps propel you into further growth and keep striving, keep persevering to be better and to continue to be better, which I just said twice in a row.
Well, that's where perseverance comes in, because the flip side of that's true too, Colin, is that that disappointment doesn't have to be the source of you trying harder and improving. That disappointment can also be the reason for you quitting. What I did, I mean, look at me. I'm right there on the screen. You see how stupid that looks? If that's what it is that I'm doing when I'm doing my best, this is clearly not for me. I should not be doing this. I just need to stop. I just need to stop. I need to quit and go on to something else. That's another perspective that somebody might take. But that's where that perseverance comes in. The idea that we don't just quit when we screw up one thing, or that we don't fail and then we just give up and move on. That there really is value in trying to continue to push through up to a point. And that's an interesting discussion in and of itself too, because at some point, quitting is probably the smarter thing to do. It goes back to the concept Aristotle put out of a golden mean. And what that is that there's a continuum on which virtues lie. So the virtues are in the sweet spot in the middle of these continuums. And at either extreme are vices. So for example, with perseverance, on one extreme, you've got giving up too easily, quitting too soon. And on the other extreme, just being straight up bullheaded or stubborn and continuing to go when you absolutely should not continue to go. And where that line gets drawn, again, there's no hard and fast rule with it, but reality has to set in. For example, if I wanted to be an NFL quarterback, I could go out and start throwing the football in my backyard. I could hire a trainer. I could go to D1, this profession, like this trainer place, and have them like work with me on my throw and all of that. Why? Because I want to be an NFL quarterback, and I can train. And I can go to the tryouts and I can fail. And I'm like, all right, you know what? I failed this time, but I'm going to keep training and I'm going to keep going. Well, you know what? I'm 48, dude. I'm not going to be a quarterback in the NFL. It's not going to happen. I don't care how much I train. So that would be a really stupid use of perseverance right there. There's somewhere in there that quitting is actually okay. But I think in general, having that grit is another construct that's been researched. Angela Duckworth from University of Pennsylvania has argued for that one over the last decade and a half or so. But this idea that that pushing forward, that tenacity is helpful and useful, I think is a good one. that is one of the determining factors in the situation that you just described. You watch yourself, you're disappointed. All right, well, you can go left or right. Left is you continue to work hard and you improve. Right is you give up and quit because you're just bad. Perseverance is what's going to determine which direction you go.
And sometimes 70% is good enough. You actually told me that. Remember when we were on the rooftop in New York and filming that little short film?
Yeah.
We were doing the sequence, doing this little fight scene, and it was pretty good. It was pretty good, but it wasn't like completely perfect. We kept on doing it and doing it. At one point you said, you know what, 70% is probably good enough on this one.
Yeah, I mean, there comes a time when it just has to be there. There's a saying, and it's been attributed to a lot of people over the years, but perfect is the enemy of good. Some people have tried to flip that around and say good is the enemy of perfect. But if we're going to be real, perfect doesn't exist, and it's never gonna. But the more we strive toward perfection, and Brené Brown has done a really good job of talking about perfection. A lot of researchers have, but she's the one I've read most recently about perfectionism and just how poisonous perfectionism can be. This continual striving for perfect is just unhealthy. And so, yeah, 70%, if that's the best we can do under the circumstances we have, then that's what we got. That's good.
It's a passing grade right there. 70% is passing.
It is under those circumstances for sure. So listen, man, we've talked about it. We've done it. There have been a lot of things. And I just wanted to wrap up with summarizing what it is that I've taken away. I mean, we've talked about education and different environments that can be created for kids and how those environments influence the extent to which kids' well-being, really, in addition to their knowledge and the knowledge that they gain, but just their overall well-being is influenced by those environments. And I'd say that that same thing is true for society as a whole. Just this idea of what kind of culture we're living in and what kind of values we espouse is going to influence the type of well-being that people experience. What else have we talked about?
I think we could start on a national campaign of getting rid of all stop signs. And maybe as a compromise, instead of doing yield signs, we could just turn every intersection into a roundabout. That's the solution. So you never really have to stop. It's all a roundabout, just like it is in London. Not every, but most intersections in England are roundabouts, and you never end up stopping, which also is a benefit because then it doesn't give you an opportunity to text on your phone at stop signs. So I think it'll just keep the flow of traffic better. We'll try to get rid of stop signs for Mr. Brian Height, and maybe we'll do more roundabouts because it keeps the flow of traffic.
Yeah, I don't know about the roundabouts. Those kind of annoy me a little bit, but I'm all for changing stop signs to yield signs. I think that makes all the sense in the world. If we need to stop, then we'll stop. No problem with that. If we don't need to stop, then by God, don't stop. Just keep going. Better for the car, better for the environment. We're burning less fuel by just sitting there at a stop sign. And then that idea of the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law, that's a big one. And I think it'll come up if we end up, and I know that we will on one of these podcasts, talking about religion, because I think that legalistic viewpoint of the rules are what they are, and these rules and laws exist. And in order for society to function, we must follow these rules because that's what's best for everybody, regardless of situation. I think that can tie into religion, and it'll be an interesting discussion when it does. But I personally don't believe that the complexities of life allow for hard and fast rules that apply across situations. I think that in every situation we encounter, we have to be open to interpreting that situation based on its unique circumstances. And I think that applies in the schools, like we talked about, to allow teachers and principals to assess their own situations with their own students and create their own environments, meeting the overall intent, because the rules are created for a reason. The stop sign is created for a reason. There is an intent there. The intent is to create a safe intersection. Well, there are rules in the school system too that are created for an intent. Well, if the teachers and principals are offered the freedom to create an environment that meets that intent without necessarily being so focused on the letter of the law, same thing within the classroom. If the teachers can create intent to communicate that intent to the students and allow the students to operate with an intent rather than letter of the law, I think that would be great too. Same thing with the police officers. Like we said, I think they should be given more latitude, more freedom to interpret situations and give a ticket or don't, or arrest people or don't, based on not just what the law says and what they have to do based on rules, but just on the extent to which whatever's going on meets or doesn't the intent of society. So that letter of the law versus spirit of the law, I think that's a cool discussion to have.
Yeah, definitely. And I agree with you. If a justice of the peace could actually really be a justice of the peace and not a justice of laws. This might seem like a lane change, but I love math. And there's been times when I had a situation with a friend, something happened, and we found a solution to that. And it's like, okay, so then another situation will come up that's very similar. And I tried to use the same equation that worked the first time in this new situation, and it didn't work. I was trying to use the letter of the law of this equation in this situation, but it didn't work when my intention should be using that as a guide, but then also recognizing the nuances and the complications of the new situation, and then apply a better new equation for each situation. In my mind, that's a simple way of summarizing what we're talking about. Let's use new equations in every situation.
I think that that idea of the rules being flexible, like I said, like the cartilage versus bone, I think there's an intent for the creation of these rules and laws. There's a reason why they are helpful, but what are they helpful for? That's the question we should ask. Rules and laws don't have values in and of themselves. They're not intrinsically valuable. They're valuable because they create a certain situation where they allow for something larger, some sort of other value or intent to occur. And that's what I think gets lost a lot of times. I think that people aren't asking the question, well, okay, this law exists. Why are you following it? Well, I'm following it because it's the law. The law is written this way. And so therefore I'm doing this. Yeah, but why? Well, because it's the law. I'm following the law. There's an intent. There's a reason that law was created. And that's what I think we should pay more attention to. Society as a whole, we talk about the importance of intent. You've brought it up a couple of times. And I think that that is, we should consider the intent of the laws, but on an individual level, intent really matters there too. Why people do what they do, the same behavior could be viewed as insidious in some situations and benevolent in other situations. For example, this is an example I used with my daughter just the other day. Imagine that you see somebody going to help an old person across the street. So there's an elderly person struggling to get across the street before the light turns green the other direction and cars start getting angry. And that's what you see. Well, why are they doing that? Well, they could be doing it because they're very helpful people. They're trying, they're looking out for the well-being of this older person. And so they're just trying to help out. Another reason might be, well, maybe they're hoping to get some money. Maybe they figure if they go help this person, the person will give them some money on the other side of it. So in each case, the behavior is the exact same, but the intent behind the behavior is different. And it matters. That intent matters. So we can't divorce behavior from intent. That, I think, is not helpful at all.
So maybe if we were to end this podcast with what you just said as like the overall quote, intent matters. See you next week.
I like it. I like it. Intent matters. See you next week. Great way to end it.
Thank you for listening to Poking Holes in Blinders. You can find us on our website at pokingholesinblinders.org, on Podbean under the same name, Poking Holes in Blinders, or also on iTunes under the same name. And Brian, why don't you tell us a little bit about your performance psychology website? And you just had a book come out, right? New book?
Yeah, it's called Begin Again, Utilize the Wisdom of Eastern and Western Ideologies to Achieve Your Full Potential. It's my first book. I'm very excited about it. And it's a different kind of book. It's not a pick it up and read cover to cover book. It has 183 short, accessible essays that are designed to be read every other day. Each essay highlights a familiar challenge like failure, stress, communication, mindset, and discusses that challenge through the lens of wisdom assembled from a wide variety of thinkers and offers practical ways to apply that wisdom in daily life. And I'm just excited to be able to put it out. And if you have feedback, let me know. I'll put a link to the Amazon place where you can get it on Amazon. That'll be on our podcast website, as well as wherever it is that you're listening to this podcast. There should be a link there too. So check it out. Also, Begin Again Performance Psychology. Yeah, if you have kids, you looking to take performance to the next level, we work with actors, singers, dancers, performers, as well as athletes of all ages. So if you or your child is dealing with any performance anxiety issues, confidence issues, motivation challenges, anything performance related, give me a shout. Let's talk, because I'd love to have a conversation with you.
That is so exciting about your new book. Congratulations. That's awesome, dude. Well, thanks again. And remember, here at Poking Holes in Blinders, knowledge infused with compassion fuels better decisions. Later!